Among our more senior scholars, we have Dr. Craig Evans, who is really a world-class New Testament scholar, has published a number of monographs and dozens of edited volumes, has appeared on many documentaries on television about historical Jesus. I'm very fortunate to have him. I myself am publishing and make that a priority alongside my teaching to continue publishing.
Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing programs to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
Today on HBU's Thinking About It, we have Dr. Timothy Brookins, who serves as the director of the graduate programs for the School of Christian Thought here at HBU, the program coordinator for the graduate theology programs, and the interim chair for the Department of Theology and assistant professor of classics and biblical languages. What do you do in your spare time? Dr. Brookins specializes in Greco-Roman context of early Christianity with a primary emphasis in the Pauline epistles. A new program, the Masters of Arts in Classics and Early Christianity, is soon to launch. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You've got a lot of jobs.
I wear a few hats and in between, occasionally sitting on a podcast.
Wow. I mean, let's go back in the life of Timothy Brookins. I mean, where are you from? And
grew up in Virginia, and
where in Virginia?
Richmond. And we had a pretty good public school system there. I started Latin at 12, which is what set me on on the trajectory that eventually became clear to me. But that only in time. Went to seminary in North Carolina at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, before going on to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I completed work in classics. And what brought me to Texas was further study in biblical studies at Baylor.
And so what was your study at Baylor?
My PhD was in New Testament, well, in biblical studies with a focus in New Testament and a cognate concentration in classics.
Wow. Man, that sounds interesting.
Love it. Well, and that's when everything began to come together for me. For a long time through my time in seminary, I toyed with which direction to go, whether to continue in New Testament study for doctoral work or whether to go on and do work in classics. And eventually what I discovered is my background in Latin early on and my cognate interest in classics converged at the point of the New Testament when I realized how important it was to understand the classical context in which early Christianity arose. So both the Jewish and the Greco-Roman history and culture.
And so classics is plural. And give us an example of the classics literature that would intersect with the New Testament writings.
Yeah, so we use the word classics in several different ways. We talk about classic books, something a little different, takes us sort of through the Western canon all the way up to the present. When we talk about the field of classics, typically what we're talking about is the history, the archaeology, and the language of Greece and Rome from about the time of Homer up through what we call late antiquity and the demise of the Roman Empire. But contemporary with the New Testament writers are, well, predominantly Latin writers have been well preserved. So the Stoic philosopher Seneca is the best contemporary with the New Testament example of a Stoic philosopher. A little bit later, Epictetus is a very well-known Stoic philosopher. Writing slightly earlier in Latin would be Cicero, who left behind not only orations delivered in court, but also a number of rhetorical works and philosophical works. And it's primarily through Cicero that a Latin or Roman tradition of philosophy has been preserved.
And what about Suetonius? Is he in the catch-all or not?
Yes, Suetonius is important too, primarily for his work in giving a biography of the emperors.
And then what about Josephus?
Josephus is extremely important for filling in gaps in our knowledge of Jewish history. So from the time the our Old Testament canon closes, it takes us up through about 400 BC. The period after that, we're indebted to, predominantly apocalyptic writing and wisdom writings that don't tell us much about Jewish history after 400 BC. We have works like 1st and 2nd Maccabees, mm-hmm. which give us the history of Judaism around the time of the Maccabean Wars, the first half of the 2nd century BC. Otherwise, we have a very dark period that Josephus fills in for us. And he brings us through that period, predominantly a work called Jewish Antiquities that brings Jewish history right up to his day. And it's written primarily as a Jewish apology to the Romans.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've heard people that are critics of Flavius Josephus who say that he was kind of a play it up to the Romans, kind of given to hyperbole, and can we trust him historically?
Right. So he was a weasel, and he was not very well liked by the Jewish people, and there are good reasons for this. So the Jewish revolt against the Romans that took place around 70 AD, he was one of the generals for the Galilean Jewish army in the revolt. As things fell apart for the Jews in the rebellion, he and some of his comrades hid themselves in a cave as the Romans came around looking for soldiers to snuff out. And the agreement that he and his friends made was that if they were found, they would each kill each other, and the last person standing would kill himself, and that person was selected by lots. Well, of course, the only account we have is Josephus's, because he was the one, he was the man left standing. And we're told that it's because he was chosen by lot to be the last man standing. Now, we don't know if that's true or not, but he was the last man standing when Vespasian found him, the Roman general. He, lo and behold, received a prophecy from heaven saying that Vespasian would be the next Roman emperor. And of course, Vespasian liked that very much and took Josephus and played patron to him and supported him as he wrote many works on behalf of the Jews after that.
You know, my wife and I are working on a project, a docuseries, and so we've filmed a lot of atheists and mythicists, and I can't even believe that a mythicist could even stand up and espouse that rather idiotic view with all that we have in history, extra-biblical literature about Jesus Christ. Can you?
Well, so Josephus, again, is a helpful witness in this instance, because other than the New Testament writers, who are biased, but I wouldn't say in a negative way, biased by the fact that they are believers in Jesus Christ and his resurrection, outside of that, we have very few early references to either the figure of Jesus or anything about his life or death. And Josephus, who's writing in the last decade of the first century, is one of the few who does give us a description. And in a pretty good paragraph, he tells us a number of things that match pretty well what the Gospels tell us about Jesus, which was that he was esteemed as a teacher. They had a number of close followers, that he was executed by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate, which roots his death to a particular time in history, and that he was reputed to have been raised from the dead. And there are some questions about whether that passage has been tampered with. And there might be good reasons for suspecting that. For example, it appears that Josephus says there that Jesus was the Messiah and that Jesus was raised from the dead.
Right.
But Josephus himself does not seem to have been a Christian, or at least we have no other reason to believe that. But in broad outline, the details that he gives us there, we think are authentic, that Josephus did in fact write the bulk of that passage. And it gives us external attestation of the life and the manner of the execution of Jesus at a particular place and time.
Wasn't there one of the Roman emperors, Trajan, or one of them that wrote about how they were actually killing followers of Christos? Or am I off on that?
Yeah, that passage is in Suetonius.
Yeah.
Suetonius says that the Jews in Rome, if this is the one you're thinking of, the Jews in Rome were expelled from the city because they were riding over Crestus. He calls them Crestus. And that seems to be a perversion or their understanding of the word Christos.
Is that reliable?
I think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that would place the event in around 50 AD, suggesting that Christianity and a teaching about a Christos or a Christ was already an issue of debate in Rome, far away from Palestine.
And would that be concurrent to the Edict of Persecution?
We have later under Nero an edict of persecution of the Christians in Rome, whom he had accused of starting a fire.
Gotcha. Tracking with you, Dr. Brookins.
Yes, sir.
There's a lot to talk about with you. Now, you went from Chapel Hill. So did you encounter Bart Ehrman at all in Chapel Hill?
We passed each other a couple times. Uh-huh. And, you know, we didn't make eye contact. So I don't know. Maybe he was avoiding me. I'm not sure.
And then you finished your PhD at Baylor.
That's correct.
And so what was the official title of your PhD?
PhD in religion with a focus in biblical studies and a concentration in New Testament and a cognate specialization in classics.
Wow.
So it's...
How long is that dissertation?
Well, it ended up being about 300 pages in its published form.
Wow, cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. Wrote on the background of 1 Corinthians.
That is neat. Very, very good. So here you are at the director of the graduate programs for the School of Christian Thought. I mean, I'm really excited about the graduate school at HBU. You know, as we both know, there are a lot of Christian universities, and we love them all, but there's, you know, you often say a Christian university, and then you say, well, what scholars are there? Mm. And often you don't have a long list.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing the people that Dr. Sloan has assembled here at HBU. It's a unique group of scholars.
It is. And if I can brag on them a little bit.
Please.
We are very strong here in the area of New Testament, and I would add classics. And while that may appear in some ways to be a little out of balance with the number of New Testament scholars we have here, it's all worth it because I think we've been fortunate enough to grab some people who earlier in their career have shown great promise and are publishing in the highest venues, which means that our work is being seen as being a central part of a conversation happening among scholars at the highest level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, give us an example of the scholars that are in our stable.
Yeah. So Ben Blackwell, Jason Mastin are two fairly recent hires who both completed PhDs at the University of Durham in England, very old and prestigious university, who have both published both single-authored books, monographs, and have now also published edited volumes, and who are now co-editing a series with Cambridge University Press on theology of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Among our more senior scholars, we have Dr. Craig Evans, who is really a world-class New Testament scholar, has published a number of monographs and dozens of edited volumes, has appeared on many documentaries on television about historical Jesus. I'm very fortunate to have him. I myself am publishing and make that a priority alongside my teaching to continue publishing in the scholarly conversations. And that fits in well with part of our vision here at HBU of making this a world-class institution that is researching and part of those big academic conversations. And I think our department in particular is leading the way in those efforts.
Couldn't agree more. When did you come, Dr. Brookins, to HBU?
I came in 2011, same year Dr. Blackwell came. And so I'm finishing up my time as an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm. And why did you come to HBU?
Undoubtedly because of the vision. The vision to make this a top-tier Christian university, which means top-tier in terms of our academic standards, but also in terms of our reputation nationwide and in terms of our involvement in the big conversations, moving forward with a Christian vision where we can raise up students that will be active in society, giving Christianity a voice and being a witness to the world. When I first discovered HBU, I was very excited by what they were doing. Hadn't heard of it previously, not being from Texas myself, but still very excited about where we're heading and the potential of this to continue forward with that vision. I think our place in Houston also poises us very well to make that happen.
I agree. Now, as the director of the graduate programs and then the interim chair for the Department of Theology, I mean, give us an idea. You got a lot of different things to direct there.
I'm directing a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
Well, with our graduate programs, we also have some graduate coordinators that do some of the work there. But my role is chiefly related to student recruitment and advising in the initial stages. Our most recent graduate program to be developed is the Master of Arts in Classics in Early Christianity. And so together with Dr. Jones, we're leading the efforts to develop this program, to get it off the ground. So the program has now been approved, and we'll be moving ahead with it in the near future. But it's one that we're very excited about that I think fills a niche or a hole that we had in our graduate programs. We had many students that were very interested in either PhD work in classics or PhD work specifically in New Testament or early Christianity. And while our other graduate programs did hit aspects of that, wasn't quite focused in the direction that they would need. So we developed this program to fill that hole. And what it involves are really three different aspects. There's the element of Jewish and early Christian history. So students are required to take a class in Second Temple Judaism, which is basically the Judaism from the end of the Old Testament up through the beginning of the New Testament period. So that fills in what for many people, unless you already have a degree in biblical studies, is really a blank spot in the history of Judaism. They're required to take a class in Jesus and the early Christian movement, which focuses on the Gospels and Acts. And then after that, we're required to take a class in second century Christianity, reading primarily the authors we call the Apostolic Fathers and the Apologists, which is another, again, very blank spot for many people who don't already have official coursework in biblical studies. Beyond that, they're required to take class in biblical or classical language, so Greek or Hebrew or Latin. And then the third component of the degree is the Greco-Roman context and culture. So they'll be required to take classes in how understanding the classical world, the history, and the culture of Greece and Rome illuminates the New Testament documents by bringing that world to life.
You know, I want to ask your opinion on something. You know, when we look at preaching today, particularly the North American context, we don't see, you know, a great superabundance of preaching, pastoral preaching, whatever, that references the New Testament original languages. Every once in a while, you might hear a little bit of it. Whereas, you know, I think about like Donald Gray Barnhouse when he went to 10th Presbyterian in Philly. The first Sunday, he started in the book of Romans, and he finished 5 years later. You know, and I think we both could look back several decades at men who truly had what I would call the gift of preaching, in that they really knew how to exposit God's word in such a way that it was not quite a seminar. It was really delving in the richness of the original manuscript. How important do you think that is today?
I think it's very important. And one of the challenges is that there's, in some ways, there's more to know now. And the professionalization of preaching means there's coursework that needs to be done in church administration and pastoral care. And the larger these Masters of Divinity degrees get, the less space there is to really master the languages. And so it's a challenge whether we continue to require the languages or require them with the same robustness that we once did, or whether we leave that to the scholars and hope that there's some kind of partnership between the academy and the church to help mediate that knowledge of the languages into the commentaries that ends up working its way into sermons and to the people. But, you know, how that balancing act is best carried out, I'm not sure. I do know that for me, understanding biblical language in the way that language works generally has greatly enhanced the accuracy with which I can read the scriptures.
And the richness of the text, huh?
And the richness.
I mean, I think about the word carnal in 1 Corinthians 3, you know, where Paul says, for ye are yet carnal, and yet the tense of the word changes. They had prolonged their weakness into willfulness to sin. Same English word. How many times do we read an English word, but we're not capturing the richness of it in Koine Greek?
Well, very often, it's also possible to import anachronistic interpretations of particular words.
Right. So
one thing that comes to mind is reference to the soul in Paul's letters. For Paul, the soul doesn't seem to be a part of the person that's very easily separable from the body. And Paul says that in the resurrection, we will have bodies. When there will be a bodily resurrection, and though it will be a transformed body, it will be a body. But thinking in terms of Platonism and the influence of the philosopher Plato, especially after early Christian history, there's been a tendency to Platonize the text. And anytime there's reference to soul, to think in terms of some immaterial part of us that survives after our body is gone and that lives in eternal bliss and soul form. That's actually not biblical at all.
Right. Right. Well, and again, I mean, in the spirit of Philippians 1, I'm for everybody preaching Christ. You know, Paul makes that provocative statement, whether they do it of envy, pretense, or truth, Christ is preached, I rejoice. I just know that when I came to Christ as a pot-smoking, druggy kid, and Job was Job and Psalms was Palms, and I didn't even know that the Bible was divided in the Old and New Testament, what really helped me in my journey was when I began to study God's Word and had some mentors that really said, you don't really know anything and you need to learn. Mm-hmm. And it built my faith. And it carried me through very, very difficult circumstances. And we are in a world today of such instability that the richness of God's Word takes a place nothing else can. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about Timothy Brookins. What's your future vision for you? I mean, I know everything you're doing, you're bringing tremendous leadership here at HBU. You specialize in Greco-Roman context of early Christianity, a primary emphasis in the Pauline epistles. What's your dreams and visions for the future?
Well, I'm doing everything I love right now. I love.
How old are you?
37.
Wow, so you're young.
I'm young. There's a lot of years ahead of me.
You bet. You got a lot under your belt for 37.
Well, thank you. So what I've been doing is something I'd like to continue doing, which is alongside my teaching here, is to continue to publish academic books, hopefully that are also a benefit to the church. So for example, 2 years ago, I published a 2-volume commentary on the Greek text of 1 Corinthians. It moved word by word, phrase by phrase, unit by unit through the entire Greek text. And while that particular commentary is really designed for people that have at least 3 semesters of Greek, it's targeting not just academics, but also graduate students and seminarians and well-educated lay people. I'm currently working on an English commentary on 1 Corinthians for what's called the Reading the New Testament series published by Smith and Helwys. So that's my most recent project to be completed within the next couple of years. And I'm under contract to do a commentary on 1 and 2 Thessalonians with Baker. So that's my more immediate future in the next several years will be devoted to finishing those projects. And that's in every way what I love to do and hope to continue to do.
And this publishing is so important because when you have a scholar continuing to publish, it's indicative you have a scholar. You know, he actually has something to write and say. Christy and I did our D-Men together under Craig Evans at Acadia Divinity College. So he's like been a mentor and friend, and not just in the classroom, but outside of the classroom, the many times we've had a chance to talk about the scriptures and talk about the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't say enough good things about Dr. Timothy Brookins. What a gift he is to Houston Baptist University and to the graduate school. And you can go to a graduate school or a school of divinity, or you can go to a school of divinity that has some real scholars that have taken the laborious time to study years to learn the original manuscripts, and it will change your entire ministry. And that's precisely what we have at HBU, School of Christian Thought. You can learn more about it at hbu.edu/Christian Thought. And I want to give your email if I can. What is your email, Dr. Brookins?
tbrookins@hbu.edu. That's T-B-R-O-O-K-I-N-S.
At hbu.edu. And do you have a website, or where? How do we figure out where you're... what you're publishing? Keep up with your
publishing. I have a faculty profile page on HBU's website with the Department of Classics and Biblical Languages. And I list there at least select publications, including probably a majority of them.
So check out Dr. Timothy Brookins' faculty page on hbu.edu. Is it under School of Christian Thought or Graduate?
School of Christian Thought. In the Department of Classics and Biblical
in the Department of Classics. And remember, we are standing by to take your calls and any questions at 281-649-3211. Dr. Brookin, just before we close, you know, we have this expansion of online. How has that impacted the School of Christian Thought? I know the Masters of Apologetics, we got students everywhere. I mean, are you enthusiastic about the online capacity?
Yeah, one of the advantages of the online program, I think, is it extends HBU like tentacles further out. And in some cases, that means somebody will complete a degree from, you know, Minnesota. But in other cases, maybe it means they start online and they decide to come and move in residence. Or students who live in the Houston area that... well, while they can make it to class on campus, sometimes they can't make it all the time. And a more hybrid approach enables them to complete a degree that they otherwise wouldn't. So I think the advantage is that it's fitting a need for people that are typically non-traditional students.
Well, we appreciate you stopping by today, and we're going to keep in touch and look forward to your upcoming publications. And when they get ready for publishing, we want you to bring them back. Let's talk about them, okay?
Let's do it.
Thank you, Dr. Burkett.
Thank you.
Here at HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.